Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Easy and affordable online therapy. When you want to be a better problem solver, therapy can be there for you. Visit BetterHelp.com/Funches today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Funches. Hi guys, thanks for listening to the podcast. Thanks for watching the podcast. Thank you just for being a supporter, like on Patreon, patreon.com/gettingbetterwithron, where you can find some exclusive episodes. You can find some thank you notes. There's just ways you can support the podcast and help us out, and we truly appreciate it. If you like playing video games and want to be a part of the Funch Bunch, go over to twitch.tv/Ron_Funches and join the Funch Bunch. Play games with me, hang out. We have a great time. It's blast playing Fall Guys, playing Rumbleverse. Come hang out with us. Also, if you're into pro wrestling, I got a new secondary podcast. I got a sidecast that we out here doing. Come out and get on board. It's called One Fall with Ron Funches. It's a Spotify exclusive. You can find that on Spotify, like I just said, and it's also on Spotify Live Sunday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. We the cross section of sports and entertainment. It's a fun time with me and my guests. We've had Renee Paquette, we've had Danhausen, we've had Greg Miller, we've had Robin Tran. It's a fun time talking pro wrestling. And if you're new and just interested in pro wrestling, or if you're an old time fan, either way, it's a fun place of positivity and humor, and I'm sure you would love it. Check out One Fall with Ron Funches on Spotify and Spotify Live. Other than that, Loot, Apple TV, Harley Quinn, HBO Max. I will be in Indianapolis at Helium soon, and also somewhere Chicago in November. We'll go ronfunches.com for tickets. Other than that, I think that's it. Let's get into the podcast. I don't want to do plugs. I'm messing them up. Here we go. I hope you're feeling strong. I hope you're feeling brave. I hope you're feeling loved and grateful for that love. I hope you're enjoying your life, having fun, the little things, the big things, whatever opportunities you get. And I hope you don't let your bad attitude or negativity stand in the way, or you just feeling like you're too cool for school. That's what can really stop a lot of people from truly living and enjoying life. You know that type of perspective when you know when you're in second grade and everybody's like, we're singing along, we're having fun, we all sing and we all have fun. And then as we get a little bit older, we're like, oh, it's stupid to sing. Why you guys singing? I don't want to sing. You guys are dumb. And that becomes part of our life, you know? But sometimes it's good to just keep that childlike behavior and just enjoy life, enjoy things. Things that you don't even necessarily, I mean, what I'm being specific about is I'm getting ready to go to my first big Emmy party. And I'm very excited about it. And it should be fun. And it's something just a few years ago, I would have been like, I'm never going to go to that. That's just two bunch of people giving each other pats on the back. And so now I see it as a chance to celebrate my few friends that are in the business to that level where they are nominated for things, to celebrate the fact that I'm in the industry at all, that I get invited to something like this, and then celebrate that I'm alive and I'm there getting invited to a party. I haven't been to a party in years. I'm going to try to stay health safe, wear my mask, keep everything together, but just still, again, before where I've been like, I'm too busy. I'd rather go do a set. I had 15 minutes at the Comedy Store than go do some Super Emmy party. Now I understand that these things are rare. I'm lucky to be even invited to stuff like this. And it doesn't mean it's not like at the heart of it, just a stupid weird corporate party, you know, like you, if you get invited to your corporate Christmas party, but sometimes they got this fun there. They got delicious snacks and brownies and you get enjoy it. And so I'm just trying to be better at embracing different things in life. At the same time, slowing down. That's what Teddy's really helping me do. We just spend more time holding him, just relaxing with him. And then that little part of me, that little itch that comes out going like, oh, I should be working on something. I should be doing something. But then I look into his big, beautiful brown eyes and I'm like, there's no place else I'd rather be. There's nothing I'd rather be doing. And there's nothing more valuable than bonding with him and spending time with him and showing him that his dad is there for him. And that's really what I want to provide for him. It's just a full family unit. You know, break that cycle of families that break apart, that aren't there for each other. There's a power to it. And it takes work and not everything will work out all the time. And sometimes if you, especially if you were in a bad situation, if you were in an abusive situation, if you were in a bad relationship, it's better to be by yourself than to be in something bad. But sometimes things just take work and you got to continue to push them and mold them and realize that the coming together of two people isn't like easy. It's like two planets forming into one and half of people dying like Thanos. You're snapping them out of existence, you know? So you got to hold on to what's important to you and let go of that other stuff. It don't matter. You're like, well, you know what? If you want to decorate that part of the house, I don't give a shit. Just let me have my arcade machines, you know? And that's part growing up, getting older, getting wiser. And it's a struggle sometimes. People going to make mistakes. I'm going to make mistakes. I'm still childish in nature and heart. But it's just fun to embrace being alive and the opportunity to get older and the opportunity to learn to master your craft and get better at your craft and to learn from more people. And that's a big part of what we were doing today with our new guests. We're going to get into that. But before that, I just want to check in on Sweaty September, see how everybody is doing. You know, if you go over to the Getting Better Instagram, you can tag in. You can see the workouts that I'm doing every day. You can see me checking in. We 12 days deep and I'm 12 days strong. No misses. We're almost halfway there. Really can't believe it. Had a little bit of a mental setback the other day when I stepped on the scale and saw that my weight was higher than I had thought it was. And that is understandable in ways. Muscle, I've been putting on a shit ton of muscle. If you go and see some of the pictures, you'll see that. But at the same time, I was still like, oh man, I thought I was leaner and smaller than that. But I'm just learning to kind of let that go and just embrace this, and just not even just the working out, but the health aspect of my life and the eating better and to try to put away, just try not eating anything packaged anymore. You know, if it's a little bag of chips or if it's a Danish in a package, you know, to me that it's a toy, it's plastic, it's poison. It's not meant for me. It's not good for my health. It's not good for my body. So I'm trying to just eat more fresh food. Vegetables, fresh meats, fresh fruits, and then just work out and sweat every day. Because, you know, in America, we work out way more than a lot of nations, but we're still fat as shit because it's not the effort. It's the food. It's the fact that they put so much poison and additives and, you know, just follow the food babe on Instagram. She'll tell you all about it. There's just so many things that they don't allow in other countries that they allow here, which is really something you would think. Again, if you wanted to say America was the number one country, then the first things you would do is say, we make the healthiest people. We don't allow corporations to poison our people, but we don't really, you know, at that, you know, we, yeah, you know how it is. But we got, we're forced to try to look out for ourselves and take care of ourselves. And it is difficult. And to not recognize that would be rude, you know. It's just hard, but you got to make that struggle. You got to make that effort. And I'm just trying, man. I'm trying my motherfucking hardest. I get frustrated about it. Again, about the weight, I hate it. But at the same time, I'm working hard. I'm feeling good. And I'm not trying to be a robot about it either. I want to be able to have a cheat meal and hang out with my son. I want to be able to go out to the party tonight, eat one or two little hors d'oeuvres, some little charcuterie, some crudité. I was mixing those two words up at first, so then they came out weird, but don't think I don't know. So I hope Sweaty September is going well with you, whether you're 12 days deep or you're just thinking about jumping in now. It is never too late to start to work on your health. Working on your physical health in turn helps your mental health. It's a big cycle. I don't know if you saw from James Winston, but it's all about symmetry, baby. You got your knees, you got your ankles, you got your toes, you got your toes. And we're trying to work on everything here. And that's another part. We have football season. Another thing I've been open to recently that I've never been open to before. First of all, you might have saw me on Sketch on NFL on Fox. You probably didn't. And if you did, you're like, what is that, Ron? I'm not sure. Either way, it's pretty cool for me. Millions of people watch that. And other than that, I'm in a football fantasy league. I'm whooping my friend Brian's ass right now. And I've never been into that either, because mostly I don't like the idea of auctioning black men for the fun and entertainment of other people. But at the same time, fantasy football is but at the same time, it's fun. I mean, we're not doing the auction style. I would never do an auction style where I have to put big money on black people like that. That's gross to me. But either way, I hope you're enjoying your life. Hope you're having fun and doing well and trying new things, even if they're silly, like fantasy football or going to Emmy parties or whatever is weird and different to you that you never thought you would do. It's just fun to get out your comfort zone. Have a good time. Enjoy your life. You could be dead at any moment. Who knows what COVID, if you had COVID and all of us did, who knows what is going, people dying of strokes and shit from it now. So that's wild. So enjoy your life. Have fun. And then again, another reason why to eat healthy and take care of your body. You never know what you're going to get to do and what other opportunities may come. Like today, got an opportunity to talk to a gentleman who was a key contributor to a publication and entity. Phenomenon that, you know, shaped my comedy, shaped my view, and made me look at satire differently. And, you know, the way when people grow up from Mad TV, you kind of moved on over to The Onion, to the AV Club. And, you know, so many great writers and great comedians and great philosophers and thinkers come from that place. And it's super cool to be able to talk to one of the co-founders, just a great comedian, great writer, great person to talk to. It's a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. I said great too much. But here one more time with the great Scott Dickers. Enjoy it.
I watched a little bit of your show after you booked me. A delightful little show you got here.
Thank you.
Sure.
We try to do fun things.
It is fun.
Well, let me tell you, if you watch a little bit, then you might know how it starts, which is by me telling you why I wanted you on the show, Scott, which is because, I mean, you've done so many great things. It seems exciting to just be near you and talk comedy when they were like, hey, do you want to talk to someone who is a co-founder of The Onion and the AV Club? And I'm like, of course I do. That's what I grew up off of and learned comedy a lot from. And so, and then now I just think you would have a unique perspective on how comedy is changing, the ebb and flow of comedy, where you think comedy is going, how much The Onion was made off of a print medium that no longer people really, it's no longer really in fashion, and how that forces The Onion to change and things of that nature. I just think it'll be fun to talk comedy in life with you. So I wanted to get to know you a little better, and I appreciate you spending an hour of time with us.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that as well.
Thank you for coming, Scott. Sure. Scott, one thing that I want to talk about from the beginning, but maybe comedy and comedy philosophy, or just how you view things, or maybe how things have changed for you, is that I watched an old interview with you and Katie Couric, I believe from 2008, perhaps. I'm not quite sure.
That sounds about right.
It talked about how when you were writing on The Onion, that it wasn't very that it was very cutthroat, not very fun for you guys. That it was all about mostly like the process of elimination and only like the strongest jokes survive. Right. And I just want to know, is that something that you still feel in comedy in the way that you create? Do you feel that it is less fun and more of a drive, or how do you work?
Yeah, I guess I am one of those people in comedy for whom the creation of the comedy is more of a drive than it is a pleasurable process. It's just like giving birth, probably is a good analogy. And so the fun comes when people respond to it favorably. And so it takes a lot of delayed gratification, long-term thinking, you know, just sit in a room and try to come up with funny stuff and just kind of agonize over it. And that's rarely for me a joyful process, but I'm looking at the long-term benefit of that, which is at some point someone's going to see or hear this and they're hopefully going to like it. And that's when my reward will come.
Now, I understand that because that's how I feel. I like to do a lot of work in multiple disciplines in comedy. And for me, I mostly feel that way when it comes to writing, where like if I'm writing on a show or writing my own project, like for the most part, I'm usually mad about it. I'm not even really happy. I'm more like, oh, like when is it going to look like I want it to look, you know?
Exactly. It's like sculpting. It's an agonizing, slow process. And you know, you hear about people and you encounter people very rarely who have this gift. They can just like pour it out and it works. Most people though have to really labor over it, and it's really hard work. If it wasn't hard, you know, more people would probably be successful at it. But
that's true.
Yeah, no, I feel the exact same way.
Is there anything in your life, a craft or a hobby that you do that is kind of the opposite of that, that you do that just brings you joy, like immediate gratification?
Yeah, there's plenty of that. You know, first of all, I appreciate that you're a multidisciplinarian because I am as well. And, you know, when you think about stand-up or performing on stage, like that's the one arena where you actually do get that gratification mm-hmm. immediately, which is what makes it, well, one of the many things that makes it so special and different from some of the other types of comedy. So that's the thing. That's one thing I've been enjoying recently is I've been performing more. And outside of comedy, there are many, many things. Like I like being outside. I like rock climbing, you know, swimming, hanging out with my boy. He just is about to turn 15. So he's a barrel of laughs. And we had a race the other day. He's waiting for the day that he can beat me in a sprint. So we're still working on that. And I put a pair of Olympic rings in my house. Really enjoy like trying to do L pull-ups all day on that. And a number of different things.
Also, you're a bit of a jock in a way.
No, I wouldn't say I'm a jock.
I would say...
No, all my physical activities are non-competitive. Like I do cycling, juggling, hiking, swimming, rock climbing. There's no teams. There's no competition. I've never been into that. That's all personal best stuff, you know.
I wanted to ask you about that because when I was looking at some of your videos, you had some very passionate takes about why you hate sports.
And yeah.
I just wanted to dig in a little bit more on that. Is it the team aspect, competition aspect? What makes you not into that?
Yeah, there's something about me that when I see almost everybody else really into something, instead of like feeling that gravitational pull to be into that thing, my immediate reaction is there's got to be something wrong with this. What's wrong with this picture? Why is everybody so into this? And football and baseball, mostly football, somewhat for other sports, I guess soccer in the outside the US. But I think it's almost like it's a poor replacement for jingoism and like war. We channel all of our warlike instincts, which we have as a species, and we put it into sports. Now, many people would say that that's good because it's better that they're playing on a field, you know, for points than actually killing people on a battlefield. But for some reason, this just leaves a sour taste in my mouth, like rooting for a team. It feels like that same well of like kill the enemy fever that we all have in us. And that just gives me the creeps.
I can understand that. And I've been that way at portions of my life. And sometimes, yeah, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan, especially of football or things like that, even though I was on the NFL on Fox last week. So I guess I'm a full sellout on that. But I'm a big fan overall. I'm a fan of like greatness and the things that I don't believe that I could ever do. So like to be able to slam dunk a basketball is a feeling that I don't think I'll ever know what that is like to just.
Well, you got to start working on that face. Vertical.
I really do. I got to start doing like those Kramer
deep knee bends. I agree. Like one of my favorite movies of all time is The Natural with Robert Redford, because it's about being great at something. Like, I don't care that it's about baseball. It could have been about bookbinding for all I care. But I love that idea of someone who's just the best at something and all of the psychosis and psychology behind that and, you know, what drives a person. Another thing, a non-competitive sport that I just thought of looking behind you there is video games. Like, I love Ms. Pac-Man. That was my game back in the day. And I could do that all day. I had to quit back in my 20s because I was so addicted to it. I realized, you know what? I'm not building any kind of career here. I'm just wasting my quarters. I got to move on and do something with my life. But I admire that you can have it in your house and do other things as well. I don't know if I could.
Balance. I never turn it on.
It's one way to beat it. It's a decoration, then. Okay.
I just have it for fun parties, and it just reminds me what I guess it's just like midlife crisis stuff, and the fact that it's where I grew up. It's where I spent a lot of time, was in arcades, whether it was before going to movies with my family or just going to the arcade at the mall. And even when I started comedy, the arcades had a special place in my heart because I didn't have a lot of money, and I was had to waste a lot of time sometimes because I would have to either drive up from another town or take the bus from another town, and I was spend a lot of time at this arcade in Portland called Ground Control, just trying to see how long I could last on like $2. So
that's great.
And now they're disappearing. So I'm like, well, if these machines are going up at auction and I got the money, I'm gonna grab them.
How much do you pay for a Ms. Pac-Man nowadays?
I think that one was about like $1,500. It's not. It's wow. Yeah.
That's more than it used to be. I remember when there was a period where after video games were big, you could get one for like $200. I guess now they have a retro value.
Yeah, and it depends on the cabinet. Some of them aren't really made at all. So yeah,
I suppose
quite expensive. Tell me a bit more about The Onion and how do you feel? I don't know if this is a weird question because I know you didn't write the article or anything like that. I don't even know if you were editor at the time that happened, but it feels so strange to me because I was watching the Katie Couric interview, and you talked about so much about how what differentiated you from shows like The Daily Show with that they were commenting on real news and real people. What you coming to real people, but you were always making up your news. And right. Then it seems like now the most well-known Onion headline is about the gun violence that is very much based in reality and realness, and it gets repeated over and over. What are your feelings about that? I don't want to lead you in any way on that. So I just want to know, what does that mean anything to you?
Yeah. First of all, I did not write that headline. Jason Roeder wrote that headline, and I did not write the article, but I'm extremely proud of Jason and proud of The Onion for coming up with that. For starters, it's really great satire because it continues to make its point every time there's another mass shooting. That article comes out and it doesn't have to say, it just repeats the same thing. And it with the message, the subtext gets drilled in deeper. And I love that. And before that, whenever there was a mass shooting, you know, the Onion can't take a break like a nightly talk show can, where the host comes out and says, "Oh, there was a tragedy today. I can't be funny. So we're going to bring on a trauma expert and we're going to talk about the trauma. We're going to talk about the problem of mass shootings." The Onion can't do that. The Onion has to be in character. It has to be do funny news. So it was starting to get really challenging coming up with a new knee slapper every time a bunch of kids got killed. It's like one of the hardest things to do. So it's a genius on two fronts because it saves the writers from having to go through that agony of coming up with something new. And it makes it deeper, more interesting, and more long-lasting point ultimately. So yeah, big fan of that article.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it as well. But on the side of someone who doesn't have any stakes on it, in some ways, the more it gets repeated, the more you feel a little bit helpless, where you're like, you know, like, we got the joke. And now can you somebody do something about this? You know, and it's exactly. just, which I guess is what good art does, makes you feel.
Ideally, yeah. And, you know, I really appreciate John Oliver and his show because he actually goes to the next step and he ropes his fans into actually doing something, which is a really interesting innovation in the whole like fake news satire space. But at The Onion, we're not, you know, doing anything. All we can do is say something and hope that it inspires people to vote differently, you know, think differently, et cetera.
Now, I talked about earlier how I want to talk about The Onion being so newspaper-based. And now as we moved in, I hate to call it a post-print media, but you see less. I mean, just as these arcade machines, you got some books and some magazines and some records that are relics back behind you.
Yeah.
How do you see The Onion navigating that future, or just you yourself navigating the future in comedy? I see you navigating more to online with your YouTube channel that you've been doing, but what do you feel about that?
I mean, I think about it all the time. And when The Onion started, it was back in 1988, and print was really the only way that you could distribute comedy other than performing. If you wanted to write comedy, you had to get in a magazine or a newspaper in some fashion. So it was a little business idea to sell ads and support the effort and keep putting out a newspaper. But then as The Onion grew, I was always really eager to get it elsewhere. I immediately got it on the radio. I think we were on the radio like year two with an Onion radio news show. And we kept doing that for many years. And then we did a comedy CD. We did a couple of TV pilots. And then in the mid 90s, when the internet became a thing and I realized you could do websites, jumped right on the website. So it's always fun for me to learn what the kind of best practices are for each new media that you go into, because you always have to rethink it. You kind of start from square one. Okay, how is this going to work in this medium? How is it different from the last medium or whatever? And so I think with The Onion, we did almost every medium. And then I started performing probably late 90s, early 2000s, and found that that was totally different. Before I ever got into The Onion and cartooning, I thought I was going to be a performer because that was what I was interested in and I kind of did more of. But then I got into all this non-performing comedy and went so many years. But all of these different media use different comedy muscles. They have different requirements. They're different audience expectations and all this stuff. So any point you drop me, like, drop me in the future, drop me in the past, I'm going to just look at the lay of the land and I'm going to try to get my stuff out there in the way that I think is best based on what's happening. So right now, clearly what's happening is social media, YouTube, TikTok, you know, like I've had much better luck on TikTok than on YouTube. Although I don't know how YouTube works. I think the algorithm, it needs you to be posting regularly for a long enough time, and then it figures out, oh, now we can start pushing this. Because every once in a while, I have a little spike or a whole bunch of people will discover what I'm doing and subscribe. And TikTok is faster. So yeah, I'm not married. Like, to me, it's about the comedy. It's about making people laugh. So I'm just going to see what the lay of the land is, and I'm going to go with it. Having said all that, I totally miss the print version of The Onion. I loved the tactile experience of having that newsprint. You know, it, of course, it's tragic that we have to kill so many trees to make that happen. And I'm still writing books. You know, I still put out a comedy book on occasion and some non-comedy books, wrote a couple of novels, and I'm going to keep doing that. But I do like continuing to operate within each of those media just to keep my muscles from atrophying, you know.
Now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp. Ooh, you ever sometimes get in a little spiral, a little shame spiral, a little problem spiral, where all you can see is the negativity around you? Lord knows I have. I remember it. When I say those words, I conjure up of a place in my mind in Salem, Oregon, called Roy Vaughn Hills, where my life was terrifying and scary, and I cried in a jack-in-the-box. And you know what would have been a better idea than crying into a double cheeseburger? It would have been talking to somebody about what I needed in my life, facing my problems, and doing that with a therapist. And the best thing I could have done is been talking with someone and facing my problems. And that's what BetterHelp can help you with. It's in the name. I know if you listen to this podcast, you know we love therapy. We are big into it. We are all about it. You know, I try it myself, and I see a therapist when I need to, and sometimes even when I feel I don't need to. And if you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, accessible, affordable, and entirely online. Get matched with a therapist after filling out a brief survey, and switch therapists at any time. And we want you to be a better problem solver in your life. We want you to feel good. We want you not crying at the bottom of a hill. Visit betterhelp.com/functions today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/functions.
Yeah, keep your skills sharp. I think that's very important. I think a lot of mistake I see, not a mistake, but a choice that I feel people make, is that they get so in love with a particular form of comedy that that's all they see in it. And particularly in stand-up, you see that a lot, where people be like, oh, they're purists in stand-up. And I love stand-up. I think it's my favorite form because it's so simple. There's so little hurdles. But I was made aware early, just simply for the fact that, like, the quickest way for me to move up in comedy and to headline, to go from, like, middle to opening to middle and to headlining, wasn't getting better at stand-up. It was getting credits in other things. And it's when I was made aware of that, where I was like, oh, this is the lowest form of the totem pole to other people. Not to me, but to other people. So I have to be aware of that and just like, well, okay, if I go off and do these shows and stuff, then I can go back and get a better deal on the comic thing and still do the thing I love. And I may love it, but in a lot of things where people love vinyl, or people love comic books, or people love arcade machines, you got to know when your thing is becoming a niche market. And if you want to survive, you do have to adapt and live in every world. And I get such a kick out of the fact that so many stand-up purists that, like, hated on, like, YouTubers coming into the performing space have now gone into their space with a great abundance.
Yes. You have to diversify. Like, it's not very smart. We saw during the pandemic, there were so many stand-ups who were devastated because they couldn't perform, you know, and the people who had other places to go and other ways to do comedy already established did fine. So if for no other reason, there's that. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
It's just as simple as complex web theory. You know, you got to have multiple streams so that your web can survive. It just makes sense.
That's right.
You talk about performing, and one of the things that I noticed now compared to when I watched your interview again with Katie Couric or some other earlier things is that you seem a little more charming now. Like before. So I was wondering if that has anything to do with, because on stage performing is not necessarily you have to be like lovable or likable. I mean, to me, I'm just kind of myself, but I, you know, like to be as if I'm hosting a dinner party. I imagine being in a writer's room, the Onion, is so much different than you being on stage and have to, you know, draw yourself and draw people in. Are there some lessons that you learn from that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So one of the reasons that I wanted to get into performing more in the early 2000s was because that muscle had totally atrophied. And occasionally we'd get an opportunity to go on TV, and we would always try to mix it up. It wouldn't always be me, even though I was like the guy in charge. We'd put other people out, and I'd go out sometimes just so people would just remember the Onion brand. They wouldn't remember a particular personality. That was important to me. But when I did go on, I felt nervous. I felt stiff. And when I would take a speaking gig or I would try to do an open mic night, I was incredibly stiff. And I was determined to loosen up. I was determined to get more practice doing that. So, you know, I did more open mics and got on stage as often as I could, kept doing, you know, paid talks and stuff like that of any kind, you know, college, corporate, anything. And yeah, I got to the point a few years ago where, you know, you reach these certain plateaus in performing. And the biggest plateau for me was finally having enough confidence in my own ability to perform on stage that I didn't feel nervous beforehand. And I wasn't afraid that I would forget what I was supposed to say. Like, I wasn't afraid to be off the cuff. I wasn't afraid to like improvise or do crowd work. Because as you well know, like, that's the most important aspect of performing is your level of confidence. If you have any kind of level of fear, the audience is going to sense that and they're just not going to be as into it. You have to be totally 100% like killer confident. And yeah, so I'm more relaxed. I'm more confident. And one of the reasons I started doing this show was that's different. That's an even different medium than stand-up. Because when I do stand-up or I perform on any kind of stage, there's some energy there because there's a live audience and you get a little feedback. But when you're talking to a camera in an empty studio, like that's deader than dead. It's like you're literally completely bombing every second. And so I wanted to get better at that. I wanted to get really good at just totally being relaxed and being myself in front of a camera. And I had some work to do. Like, it was surprising. I had gotten to the point where I was comfortable on stage, but I was still a little awkward in front of the camera. So that interview you're talking about on CBS Sunday morning back in 2008, that was a really early time for me to be on camera. Like, I was really stiff and serious and had not done much work on that at all at that point, you know?
Yeah. Well, it seemed, yeah, I could see the progress.
I'm glad you can see it. Because it definitely, I feel it, you know.
Well, absolutely. There was something that you said that I wanted to expound on, but then I got so wrapped up in you talking, I think I forgot. So I'll just move on to my next question.
All right.
Which is just, we love to talk about goals on this podcast. So if you would like to share just any goals you're working on, whether it be spiritual, professional, I mean, you already kind of talked about something that you plateaued on and reached. Oh, now I remembered. I reached a great plateau. The great plateau for me in stand up is when I could eat before a show. If before I couldn't do anything, I would vomit. I would be freaking out.
And that's then, a good benchmark.
Yeah. Now that if I can, like, oh, if I'm hungry, I can eat. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Cause if you can't eat before you perform, like, you have to like starve yourself all day or just for a few hours before the show.
just a few hours beforehand. Oh, okay. But it's a whole nerve thing for a while. It's because you feel the nerve. And it'll still creep up depending on how big a situation is for me. But I love that. I love that feeling when I love when I conquer that feeling, because then it kind of, you know, it builds the confidence. Like you said, yeah. When I kind of liken it to if you were getting on an old like wooden roller coaster, and this comedian, the performer, is the person who's running the roller coaster. And if I look like I know what I'm doing, that I've done this before, I'm telling you to strap in. We're going to have a great time. No matter if it looks rickety to you, you're going to get on it and you're going to have a great time. But if I'm fumbling around looking like I don't know what I'm doing, you might get off that ride. And I feel
it's
like
that's analogy. Yeah, great analogy.
Well, okay. So, well, I'm glad I talked about it.
Yeah. And one of the other things people who don't do this always think is that you're going to be more nervous in front of a bigger crowd. But I find the bigger the crowd, the less nervous I am. Mm-hmm. Because you get more laughs. It feels more full. Like the worst is a comedy club with three people, or, you know, like I said, a camera in an empty room. It's almost worse. But as far as goals, yeah, I love goals. I'm all full of goals, and I've always had them. They are what drive me. So right now they're largely personal. Like I have a goal of maintaining my health for as long as I can. You know, in America, people, they don't take care of themselves. They have too much stress. They eat terribly. And I'm determined to counteract that. And I'm not hedging my bets, because I don't have any health insurance. So my health insurance is my diet. And, you know, Plato said, let medicine be thy food and food be thy medicine. So that's how I live and how I eat. Incredibly disciplined diet that I hardly ever cheat on. And it's tough. Like I've gone months without any kind of sugar or processed food or even fruit sugar, like just vegetables and meat for months, you know.
And walk us through a daily diet for you. This is interesting for me.
Okay, yeah. Good. What's a daily diet for me? So I unfortunately cannot be vegan. I tried it and it doesn't work for my body type for whatever reason. But I always make sure to buy clean meats. So there are meats that are pasture raised and they don't eat any like GMO grains or anything. So I have like 3 ounces of meat and some sort of vegetable for a meal. Like this morning for breakfast, I had broccoli. So I just chop up a whole bunch of broccoli. And what I do is steam it and puree it, because you don't have enough time to chew vegetables if you eat enough vegetables. But if you puree it, you make a soup out of it, eat it really quick, and you get all that nutrition. I'm not into juicing. I used to do a bit of that, but I don't like that because I want the fiber, you know? So that was breakfast. And then another typical breakfast would be just a slab of a different kind of meat, 3 ounces or so, and then like a whole bunch of kale, like steam the kale, blend it, eat it like a soup. And it's just the vegetable oil, and I always got to get the quality oil. It's like avocado oil, coconut oil. My favorite is sesame oil, non-cooked, like raw sesame oil is delicious, best oil. And salt and pepper, that's it. That's all you need for a soup. And so like for dinner, I just had a bag of frozen peas. I always get organic, absolutely always get organic. And I try to get at the farmer's market when I can. So I know the farmer and I know how they grow the stuff, because the other stuff isn't as nutritionally dense. So I had a little 3 ounces or so of meat and a bag of peas for supper. That's what I ate. So that's how I live.
It's very simplistic.
It's very simple, very paleo, very keto. I'm probably constantly in a state of ketosis,
mm-hmm.
You know, so it's, it works for me. It works really well. My body is very happy.
When's the last time you had ice cream?
That's a good question. Probably a few months ago. I probably stopped at Culver's and had a cheat meal with, you know, a couple of butter burgers and a custard.
Wow. So, wow. Yeah. Wow.
You got to cheat. You can't do this all the time. Every once in a while, you got to have a cheat.
Okay. So how often do you have a cheat meal? So a couple months, you say?
Yeah, I would say I probably do it every 2 or 3 weeks.
2 or 3 weeks. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. I'm trying to get there. Is it, you know, food and diet has been one of the, you know, biggest battles in my life. It comes from a lot of trauma with food in my background. A lot of, you know, just covering of feelings and pain with food. And now as I get in older and I enjoy what I do and I love my comedy and I have my new 4-month-old baby, I'm like, I want to be around. Maybe I could be a grandparent. I don't know. Who knows? I'm not trying to put that pressure on him now, but maybe if so, yeah. I'd like to be around, or at least say that I did my best to be around. What I would really like is for no one to be like, oh, I knew that's how he was going to die.
Oof, you know? Yeah, that's rough. That's rough. And it's, you're right. It's tough. We have so much baggage with food. It's a really tough issue. And also we're hardwired for instant gratification, and delicious food that's bad for you is so easy to get. It's cheaper. It's more convenient, you know? So it really is a lifestyle change. And part of what helped me was I got diagnosed with celiac disease a few years ago, so I couldn't eat the gluten anymore. And so there were no more dinner parties. You know, you can't go out to somebody's house for dinner because nobody can be expected to cook a completely gluten-free meal because their kitchen has gluten and there's going to be cross-contamination. So, and being a recluse didn't hurt either. So the celiac disease was kind of a handy excuse to not have to go out to dinner with people or go out to people's houses. And so, yeah, I just like hole up in my house and eat my vegetables and I'm happy.
That sounds fun. You sound like a caveman in a lot of ways, which I enjoy.
Yeah, no, I you know, certainly eating the diet of a caveman. Well, and I do live in a cave shaped apartment. So yeah, I'm replicating the Neolithic lifestyle as much as possible.
Are there any other goals you'd like to share with us?
Boy, yeah, I had a goal recently and I failed spectacularly at it, but I kind of...
Oh, thank you. I love one of these.
Yeah, I reinstituted almost every year, and that is write a book a month. So I've kept it up...
A lot of people go the other way. Are you sure this is... You know it's supposed to be read a book a month.
Yeah, well, I read plenty of books. What I want to do is write a book a month. So I've kept it up for 2 or 3 months in a row, but then something always comes up, you know? And for the last 2 or 3 years, I've probably written on average 3 or 4 books in a year. And then I look back and I figure that's pretty good. Most people do not write 3 or 4 books in a year. So I like having these goals because even if you miss, you're still among the stars, you know, that whole saying.
Absolutely.
So I might shoot for that again come January. I'm not normally like a tradition person or a holiday person, but New Year's does always start to make me think of resolutions. In fact, I start thinking about them like around November. That's usually when I have my big epiphany about here's what I'm going to do now. And then I start doing books. So I'm working on a new book now. It's a humor book, but I want to write more novels and I want to write more books about how to do comedy. I've done 4 of those. I got a 5th one in the works. So yeah, I got a lot to say and I need to get it all on paper before I die. How I feel about it.
I like that. That's so extraordinary and in some ways wild to me that you hold yourself to those standards. But I'm a big fan. I mean, you would not be aware. We just met each other. But one of the things that we like to do and that one of the reasons I started this podcast is that for the past 5-6 years on
New Year's Eve or around that time, the way I celebrate it is by we usually do a vision board party where I get my group of friends over because I'm not a I don't drink. I'm allergic to alcohol.
And that's handy.
It's very handy. It was very helpful for stand up and not fall into drink tickets and things like that.
Yeah.
but so I was looking for ways to go enjoy New Year's Eve without being drug out to a party or something I didn't want to go do. And so we would just start by having a group of friends come over and we'd write our goals out. We just very like elementary school where we put the construction paper out, get the glue, make collages, the goals. And I think a big part of it is that we would then have to tell each other what our goals were. And not only was it helpful in building in courage of saying what you want to do. And in some ways, it helped people connect to each other of like who had similar goals and were in similar fields. And it's been something that's grown year after year. And even in the pandemic, we did it over Zoom. And so that's pretty much. And then I like to check in like July or so, reassess my goals. And some of them are long term, short term. Some of them are very just me materialistic. I still want to get a Japanese toilet for the upstairs bathroom, but these are my goals. These are the things that I want. Otherwise, I don't see a point of like living. You're just floating around, you know?
Yeah, drifting on the water. That's a great idea. Vision boards are fun. They have this thing now, the vision video, where you like put together a moving, you know, vision board. I've never done that, but there's a company actually you can pay to they'll make it for you.
That's interesting.
But my biggest challenge isn't the writing of the books. It's this new show. Like I've committed to doing at least 10 minutes of new stand-up material every week. And that's the one that kicks my ass, is actually coming up with 10 minutes of new stuff and then doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so valuable for me. It's so valuable.
You write very differently than I, though, right? It seems like you write very topical. Like it seems, or not necessarily topical, because it's almost as if like you just sum up everything that's been happening in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I try to mix it up and have some topical stuff and some evergreen stuff. It's so interesting, like, you know, the way you're supposed to do stand-up is you try out jokes, see which ones work, and then refine those, and then those become part of your act. But the way I'm doing it is a little more slow because I'm on video and I'm on YouTube, and social media responds to more controversy, you know, and mm-hmm. more like pushing people's buttons. So I'm necessarily gravitating to that. So if I have a really strong opinion, and I do just so happen to have a lot of really strong opinions that are very different from most people. Mm-hmm. So going out there with those is good for me. Like some of the more like clean comedy, evergreen comedy isn't doing as well as the kind of controversial current events stuff.
Oh yeah. You sum up why I don't do well online. You really summed up my issue.
You're doing the clean comedy. But that's the thing. Like, it's different media, different rules. So if I go on stage, I do more of the clean comedy. I do more of the evergreen stuff. People on stage are very uncomfortable with the controversial current events stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain like safe or clean current events material you can do. But anything that would blow up online would probably get like weird murmurs and gasps from a live crowd. This wouldn't be worth it, you know?
Yeah. For me, it just, a lot, the reasons why I got into comedy were a lot based on being a contrarian to not wanting to have a job and not feeling like I was doing things I didn't want to do. And for me to talk about, it was one of the biggest things I had. You talk about like to me, there was this like the same track that you saw a change in The Onion and online and social media things where like in the beginning days, social media is where I thrived because it was a lot of like just
fun ideas and off the cuff things, whatever you could imagine. That's where I live in my world. And then it became like, what's the funnest, weirdest, meanest joke you could write about this politician or this senator or this president? And that's where I don't thrive, just because it's almost like this level of like, duh to me, where I'm like, yeah, I don't like this person. You should know that. Why are we going to spend our time? Why am I wasting my time talking 10 minutes about how we all don't like this person, you know? And so it just makes it harder for me. It's one of my opening jokes where I go like, this is a job about strong opinions and I don't care about much. So it's very difficult.
Yeah, that was a good Norm Macdonald bit where he would go up and say, you know, I don't have any strong opinions about anything. You know, I promise I don't have any opinions.
You know? Yeah, I'm in the same boat.
He would just spout the opinion that he last heard and pretend it was his own.
That's fun. Yeah. Oh, Miss Norm, what a great comedian.
Yeah, what a treasure. Did you read his book? I really enjoyed his book.
No, which book?
Forget what it's called, but it's his only book. It's an autobiography. And it's really quite a great piece of work. He reads the audiobook as well. If you want to listen to him.
That sounds fun. I think I will do exactly that.
I recommend it highly.
Well, that's, speaking of which, that's fun. I mean, even though Norm is dead, so that'd be a weird recommendation. But what are there any other comedy? Are there things that inspire you? It doesn't have to necessarily even be comedy. What makes you laugh? What do you enjoy right now?
Thanks for asking. I have been on a kick lately where I'm trying to watch every comedy documentary there is. Mm. And I'm discovering some really interesting comedy that I didn't know about, and learning so much more about comedians that I did know about. Great documentary about Bill Hicks, mm-hmm. About Barry Cummins. Mm-hmm. Is that how you pronounce it? Is that the last name? Yeah.
Yeah. Crimmins, I believe.
Crimmins. You're right. Barry Crimmins. Yeah. He's not a household name, not a well-known guy, but they made a documentary about him and it's fascinating.
By Bobcat Goldthwait, I believe.
Yeah. He directed it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because he was one of his sort of mentees. Mm-hmm. And learned about Brocket 99, this whole thing in Canada. And that's really inspiring. I like hearing the life stories. Today I was into Dudley Moore and Peter Cook. Like, I wanted to learn all about them. I didn't know Peter Cook bought Private Eye, the British satire publication.
I didn't know that either.
Very interesting. And I feel bad for him because Dudley Moore really took off in the late 70s, became a really big star. And, you know, they remained close. But, you know, Peter Cook was just as brilliant as Dudley Moore, but he didn't get the same. So yeah, stuff like that. I like hearing people's personal stories. That Judd Apatow 2-part documentary on Gary Shandling is a treasure. Mm-hmm. So that's what's been doing it for me lately.
Yeah, Gary Shandling one really refocused the way I think about comedy, and it changed to this day. Because before I used to always start with like a pre-written joke that I had ready to go. And now whenever I write a set list, like the number one thing I write on my set list is just be in the moment and just enjoy, just try to avoid your set for as long as possible. And that's really helped me enjoy comedy a lot more.
That's good. Yeah. It's such great Zen advice about comedy from Gary Shandling. You can't beat it.
Have you watched The Dangerous World of Comedy by Larry Charles?
Don't think I've seen that one yet.
You might enjoy
it. I'm sure it's on my list.
It's a series, but it is, it's really enjoyable because it talks about comedy from a lot of different perspectives and from a few different countries, for people who are doing, like women who are doing comedy in places where women aren't supposed to be having any rights. And
oh, that's of great interest to me. Yeah, I should check that out. Like the people who do like comedy satire publications in Iran and China.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah, check it out.
Yeah, and I've really been into Maria Bamford. She's one of my favorite comedians right now. Her comedy is just so unique. I love comedy that's different. that somebody just doing something totally different, but also something that's really uniquely them. It's not a shtick, you know? Mm-hmm. And her comedy just has always felt very genuine and just like going through all her stand-up specials lately.
Yeah, yeah, she's the best. I love, she's an earth really angel. Good. That's what I call her.
she is.
Yeah, she's great. Okay, Scott, I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, it was my pleasure, sir. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. The way that we usually land this podcast is by just asking for a little piece of advice, a little pearl of wisdom. It could be anything, whatever pops into your mind when I'm speaking this, just something to help our getting better community to get better.
Well, what a lovely way to close out a podcast. Since we've been spending so much of our time talking about comedy and doing comedy, I guess the advice that I would throw out there is comedy based, and that is put yourself out there. You know, don't hold it in. I see so many people trying to perfect something so they never put it out, or too nervous to go out, and just bury all that, forget all that. Don't worry about the reaction. Just have fun. Go out there, put yourself out, and keep putting yourself out. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that's where the fun, that's where the reward is going to come. And it's almost like coins in a slot machine. Like, you just have to keep doing it, and eventually you're going to get a payback. Mm-hmm. And you may not know when or how, but if you enjoy the process and keep doing it, keep putting yourself out there, you've won. Like, you're living the dream. You're doing what you love. You're doing what you want. And really? Who cares what... if people don't recognize how good you are yet.
That's beautiful advice. That's great advice. I think, yeah, it's just about perspective. Remember how beautiful it is at the very base level to be able, in a world where it's so easy and so many people choose to destroy and to tear down, that if you have the ability and you have the calling and you have the skills to create, uh-huh. Like, you're blessed, and that's beautiful, and that's lucky, and that is also a duty. And in order to fulfill that, you have to just create. And that is something in the pandemic that I've really thought about, and being locked in with myself and having and receiving failures, things that where I was like, oh, this is something I really want to do, and I feel like I'm called to do it, and it doesn't work out. I have to then kind of back away and just go like, oh, I'm just here to create. I'm not here to comment on these creations. Let other people comment on it and talk about it and decide, you know, if the director wants a second take. I used to take so many things like that personal. Like, I made a mistake. And I had to really back away from that and just be like, I'm just a vessel to create and to put things out. And that's it. I don't need to worry about the rest.
Yeah, that's good. Just like, you know, be a force of nature and just go out there and do your thing. Mm-hmm. And that's the ticket, in my opinion. That's really the key.
Our friend Ryan Hurst called it working in neutral, where you're neither pushing nor pulling. You're just creating and enjoying.
That's an interesting way to put it. I always think of it as drive. I always think of it as like pedal to the metal, because it does take so much wrenching hard work to actually put yourself out there. Balancing that with that Zen feeling that you're talking about of just being in the moment, being yourself, being in neutral, that's some sort of Jedi level of balance that we can all aspire to achieve.
I want to get there. It will be fun. Level mastery.
Absolutely.
Well, Scott, I mean, I really want to just take the time to say I'm grateful for you spending the time, because, again, just without the work that you and your team have done, it, you know, really shaped my comedy in the way that I looked and viewed at the world and felt less alone. So I just appreciate that very much. And the fact that I get to sit now, years later, and actually spend some time talking with you about comedy means a lot to me. So I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for saying that. It was my pleasure, and you're welcome for all of the comedy in The Onion. It's been my pleasure.
Is there anything that you want to promote, or your where people can go see you or find your work?
Yeah, they can check out my show, which is Scott Dicker's Around. That's the show where I try to do 10 minutes of new material every week to make myself accountable. And, you know, if anybody wants to reach out, I'm pretty approachable in the computer. If you Google me, even if you spell my name wrong, I show up.
Yeah, but if you spell it too wrong, you get a porn star.
You'd have to spell it pretty wrong. It's Scott Dickers, 2 K's, no C. But even if you do a C and a K, you're going to be fine.
Scott, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ron. Thanks for having me.
And thank you guys for listening. Bye.
Take care.